Okay, so as I said, we're going to back up a little bit and go through the crossing of the Red Sea, I hope. Maybe I better start the slideshow. Hey, it works better now. This is the map showing the traditional route of the Exodus, the one that's been most commonly used in recent years. And basically this red line would show the route that most people thought that they took, although they spending their time in this area, it's hard for us to know for sure. And nobody really knows that this is where how they went. Is just this is the way that most people believe that they went, or at least what's been taught in recent years. The guy named Ron Wyatt has been studying this, apparently spent a long period of time. I pulled this information down off the web. This is a quote from him. He said, "The children of Israel lived in the Nile Delta, or the land of Ramses, and the first encampment at the northern end of the Gulf of Suez, or Succoth, at the beginning of the Exodus. This was the first point where they went into the camping mode. Then they traveled through the wilderness of the Red Sea, or what we call today the Sinai Peninsula. And after 3 days of fast traveling, they encountered the Gulf of Aqaba at Nuweiba, Egypt." 1 Kings 9:26, he says, calls the Gulf of Aqaba Yam Suf, or the Red Sea. "When traveling through the wilderness of the Red Sea, escaping Pharaoh's army, God told Moses to turn south, so they headed through the Wadi, or canyon area, that is called the Wadi Watir, which led to the sea." So Wadi is a dry riverbed, basically, that maybe carries water in it during some times of the year, but for most of the year is dry. There's a few problems with what he has said here. 3 days of fast traveling. Now, if we want to think about... went the wrong way, I guess. You've got to move 2 or 3 million people and all their livestock in 3 days from here to here. And I'm sorry, but I'm not going to believe that. When I was younger, there was a fad going around of taking 50-mile hikes. So you hike 50 miles in one day, late 60s. I never did it, by the way. But that's somebody setting out with nothing but a backpack on, nothing to carry them, slow them down, no small children, no herd of livestock. You could have covered that distance in 3 days in that mode. But these people weren't in that mode. They had large herds of livestock, they had small children, they had their families, they had their possessions, whatever that was that they could carry, and they didn't cover that distance in 3 days. So whatever he's saying about that, I'm firmly convinced that he's wrong about that. Now he says, God told Moses to turn south. And the scriptures, again, don't indicate that God told Moses to turn south. It's necessary to fit his theory. And he may be right about where the crossing of the Red Sea occurred. But this statement has, like I say, those two problems in it. And we can address both of those, I think, to some degree. We know that God told Moses to turn certain ways. God was leading them with the pillar of cloud by day and the pillar of fire by night, so that God was leading them where they went. So if God decided to turn south, he didn't have to tell Moses to turn south. He just turned the pillar of cloud south, and they followed it. So let's say these are minor difficulties with this man's interpretation of what's going on. If we look here, though, in Exodus 16, it says, "They set out from Elam, and all the congregation of the sons of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin. Now, this was after they had crossed the Red Sea. It's on the 15th day of the second month after their departure from the land of Egypt. So we're looking at 6 weeks, and they're across the Red Sea. So the assumption that they got across there in 3 days makes no sense at all. The necessity for them to make that across there in 3 days is not required by the scripture. It was 3 days after they crossed the Red Sea until they reached Marah, where they found bitter water. So that's the only mention of 3 days that I see in the scriptures about this whole trip. But by that time, they had been on the road for 6 weeks. Now, it also seems that the likely assumption that most people make is that Pharaoh decided the day after they left it was time to chase them. And it probably wasn't the day after. It probably was several days after, maybe even as much as a month before he set out to pursue them. And he had to gather his army together and head out to chase them. So we've got a month for them to get across this territory. And this is the route that he says they followed. The first part of this route down to here where you see this sudden turn to the south was a well-traveled trade route. So the caravans took this route all the time, which means it probably was the easiest route through that part of the country, which would make sense, again, for them to try to follow that route. And so this is what he is claiming happened. He may well be right, but not in 3 days. Give them a month. We're looking down here. There's a legend here at the bottom. I don't know whether you can read it. It says this is 80 miles. And so we're talking here, this route, probably 160 miles, maybe 200, something like that, depending on just how many sharp turns and winding paths there were to follow in that particular route. But in a month, they could probably cover that. And that seems a far more likely scenario to me, regardless of where they crossed the Red Sea, that it wasn't in 3 days, it was more like a month. Can't prove it. My theories. Dan? Yes. Yeah, that would be, and they didn't have wagons. These guys were on foot. So they're carrying everything that they've got with them. They don't have the wagons to carry it in. At least that's what I read in the scriptures, that there's 600,000 men on foot. But they could have covered this distance in a month. But I doubt they would have covered it in much less than that. Okay, he comes down here. He's got this wadi, this dry riverbed that he's following down to this point here. And here at the town of Noiba, however you pronounce that. It's an Egyptian town, apparently. It lets out into this large beach area here, which is where he says the crossing took place. Apparently, an underwater ridge through here. The water on either side of it is 5,000 or 6,000 feet deep. But there is a relatively shallow, only a few hundred feet, place there where there is this underwater ridge where they could have crossed on. So this is the point that he sees. This picture is looking down from the hills there with where the wadi is down into that beach area. So there's a large area there that could support the children of Israel staying there for a few days. And I didn't put any of the pictures in this of what he's got. He has found there in the water wheels from Egyptians, from chariots that would been the style that the Egyptians were using in that particular period of time. And apparently they didn't use them for very long. So would indicate that sometime about the time of the children of Israel leaving Egypt, a large Egyptian force somehow floundered in the water there at this location. Probably that's your best evidence that this may well be where they crossed. But it requires us to rethink some of the ways that we have been thinking about all this all the time. Bill?
You don't know how far across that is. I'm just curious.
I think there is a legend here. Back up one more slide. That says right here that this distance is 7 miles. So we're seven or 8 miles across here. Again, we don't have any proof of any of this other than what this guy has found. It may turn out to be that archaeologists in the long term agreed that this is the site of that crossing. And there is apparently enough evidence for that it has a fairly strong case. Okay, so wanted to bring that up. This is somewhat recent, the last 30 years or so that this guy's been propounding this theory that this is where the crossing occurred. It also has the point, though, of putting Mount Sinai on the other side of the Gulf of Aqaba from where it has traditionally been located. So that Mount Sinai would then be over in Saudi Arabia rather than on what we now call the Sinai Peninsula. The locations that we have today, he says, were generated by some people about 400 A.D. So they were 2,000 years after the fact. And apparently there was this woman that supposedly had some powers, and she was going around pointing out all these sites. Whether she had any real knowledge or anything at all, it'd be kind of strange. So if that's the case, those locations are not very believable either. Don? Midian was on the other side of the Red Sea.
Right. And so I thought it was Michael, Moses was the shepherd, and his father's flock was in Midian, all the way over on the bottom of the Sinai Peninsula, where Mount Horeb, or Mount Sinai, where that's traditionally where it is. So in that case, if they went across there and Mount Sinai was over there, in a way that would make more sense.
It would make more sense in some regards. Let's back up and take a look at some of these maps here. This one shows Midian as being over here. And the trade route went this way, went around the Gulf of Aqaba and up this way to get to Egypt. So there was trade between the Midianites. Obviously, Joseph was picked up by a group of people, or at least partly Midianites. And they went around this way to get up to here. And if you look at that other map, the children of Israel followed this same trade route until they got over into this region and then dropped south down to here. So, but yes, Midian definitely was across there on the other side of the Red Sea. I don't think there's any contest about that at all. Bill? Yes.
And this was a miracle, a miracle that showed everyone that this is, the God, Jehovah is God. And otherwise, he would have led them down like you the other side of the sea, if that's where they were headed to begin with. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
They didn't go, oops, we went down the wrong side. I'm sure.
They could have gone around the Gulf of Aqaba on the path they were on. But then there would have been no place for God to perform this particular miracle. If they were going to fight a battle, the area they were in, they could disperse their families out onto here and could have set up a defense back up in the mountains along both sides of this wadi and given the Egyptian army a good fight there. But children of Israel weren't ready for a battle at this point in time. They had fought the Amalekites, or will fight the Amalekites. That's the only battle they find. They're not prepared to go up against the Egyptian chariots. So would have been some possibilities there. But you also look, if you're going to give the Egyptians the control of this region, they're trapped. There's no way out of this particular area that they can get through. So they're stuck with somehow getting across this 7 or 8 miles of water. Don?
Which would also mean that Amalek would have been over there, and the wilderness that they wandered into 40 years would have been further east, and all of that
would have been over on the other side of the Gulf of Aqaba. Much bigger territory. It's also arid desert. That whole region is. Mike?
And by keeping the Egyptians back in that area where the mountains surrounded them, they also were prevented from trying to outflank the Israelites. Of course, the pillar moved to protect them, but at the same time, it made it more difficult.
But it did put them in a trap. If they weren't going to meet those chariots in that back up in that canyon, they were trapped. The Egyptians could come out on them anytime they wanted. And they were scared. They felt trapped. There had been other places where they could have fled either direction from the Gulf, from where we normally would have them crossing the Gulf of Suez. They could have had a better chance of escaping in that route. Here, there's no chance. They're trapped by this Egyptian army that's coming down on them. And like I say, if you want to go in and do a web search on Red Sea Crossing, you'll find all this guy's material there. He's got some books he'd like to sell you espousing this particular theory. Oh, okay. Mike?
I just had a question about the Egyptians. Did the destruction of their army, did that pretty much destroy their country, or did they recover from this?
Well, they recovered from that without any problem. It took the Pharaoh out, as well as his army itself, but the Egyptian people were still controlling the Nile River and the delta down there. And that was really the land of Egypt was right along the Nile. They controlled all of this area here. The ruins of an Egyptian fort at the north end of this beach area here that you see. And they think that is the Migdal that's mentioned in the scriptures. Andrew? Oh, yeah.
The army was devastated, and even their religion, to a certain point, was devastated. So that would have allowed Israel time in Canaan to get planted well without the Egyptians coming back up and trying to trying to take them over or get after them. They weren't a major power for quite a while.
Yeah, Egypt was a powerful nation at that time, and they did have tributaries, at least up in Palestine. They were the nominal rulers of that part of the world in these days. And the destruction of this army and the devastation caused by their loss of 600,000 men for slavery would have been a severe blow to the economy. And for them to have survived that, without somebody else coming in and taking over would seem like a pretty remarkable event in itself anyway. But that's kind of where that stands. Okay? Now I'd say, this is interesting. It doesn't have anything to do with the man Moses. But it's kind of interesting, and the discussion came up, so I thought I'd go back and try to cover this a little bit more. Any other comments? Yes? Yeah. Yeah, we have no description in the Bible of what route they took. Some places are mentioned, some names, but they're not names which we have any knowledge of today. He does say that there are two pillars that were supposedly erected by Solomon, which would have been about 400 years, 400 to 500 years after the crossing of the Red Sea. That denotes that this was where that crossing took place. Whether those pillars are really that old, whether somebody else put them up, AD 400, I don't know. But that's what the archaeologists are telling us today. And so it's, like I say, it doesn't have any effect on our salvation at all, whichever way we want to believe that it took place. The only thing that would be problematic for us is if we tried to be adamant at one place or the other and required somebody else to believe it. And the Scripture doesn't want us to do that, so we'd be adding to what the Scripture says if we did that. Mike?
It goes to the point as well that for many, many years, archaeology in that part of the world has been guided by the Scriptures. They use it as their most reliable sources of information in many instances to establish probable locations. And typically, the generalities are confirmed by archaeology. And so, although it doesn't prove a particular passage of Scripture or anything that God specifically said, it does give us the context that it's something that happened in history and can be even found, traces of it can be found even to this day.
Yeah. Yeah, the fact that they're finding artifacts of an Egyptian army in the water, I suppose it was always possible that some historical event that we have no record of, an Egyptian army trying to use boats to cross the Gulf of Aqaba at this point and got floundered in a storm or something could have happened to create those artifacts that they're finding down in the Gulf of Aqaba at this point. But we've absolutely no knowledge or indication of that either from secular history or the Bible. So this gives some credence to what Ron Wyatt is claiming at this point. Okay, let's go back on to where we were. And this is where here in Exodus 15, we covered this last week. They went out into the wilderness of Shur and went 3 days in the wilderness and found no water. But this was 3 days after they crossed the Red Sea, not 3 days before they crossed the Red Sea. Doesn't require them to have spent 3 days getting from Succoth to wherever they crossed the sea. That's been sort of an assumption that a lot of people have made. And it probably takes us away from what may really have happened. And I can say, although it's not really all that important to us. They set out from Elam, and all the congregation of the sons of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin. And to in verse 2 there, the whole congregation of the sons of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. The sons of Israel said to them, "Would that we have died in the Lord's hand, by the Lord's hand in the land of Egypt, and we sat by the pots of meat when we ate bread to the full, for you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger." So before they were going to be killed by thirst, now they're going to be killed by hunger. And they're grumbling about it. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you, And the people shall go out and gather a day's portion every day, that I may test them whether or not they will walk in my instruction. On the sixth day, when they prepared what they bring in, it will be twice as much as they gathered daily. So Moses and Aaron said to all the sons of Israel, at evening you will know that the Lord has brought you out of the land of Egypt. In the morning you will see the glory of the Lord, for he hears your grumbling against the Lord. And what are we that you should grumble against us? So it seems here that the children of Israel are gathering or grumbling against Moses and Aaron, the two people who are leading them. And Moses tells them, but he seems to be getting a little bit sensitive about this, that this will happen when the Lord gives you meat to eat in the evening and bread to the full in the morning, for the Lord hears your grumblings, which you grumble against him. And what are we? Your grumblings are not against us, but against the Lord. So he's trying to divert some of the grumbling from him. He seems to be getting a little bit sensitive about it, perhaps. He's not been used to handling the pressures that associated with leading 2 or 3 million people around. And he points out that it is God who is setting their route, not me. I mean, we're following this cloud that God put out here before us. I'm not the one responsible for being where you are at this point in time. A rather human reaction to what is going on. And so we don't think about this in Moses' case, but he seems to be getting a little bit sensitive about what all the pressures and the complaints that are coming against Moses himself. So he talked to them again. We covered this last week. At twilight you shall eat meat, and in the morning you should be filled with bread. And you should know that I am the Lord your God. And it came about at the evening that quails came up and covered the camp. And we talked about this last week. I know that anybody who's ever been quail hunting may go out and spend the whole day in the field and not get anything. In this case, the quails came into the camp and they just had to kill them. And this went on for 40 years, that the quails would come up to the end of the camp every evening. And in the morning, they would find this stuff on the ground. They go out and gather it up, and that became the bread. They could cook with it. They either boiled it or baked it, and that was what they had to eat for bread and for meat. Okay? On the sixth day, they gathered twice as much bread, 2 omers for each one. And all the leaders of the congregation came and told Moses. And he said to them, this is what the Lord meant. Tomorrow is the Sabbath observance, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. Bake what you will bake, boil what you will boil, and all that is left over put aside to be kept until morning. So they put it aside until the morning as Moses had ordered, and it did not become foul, nor was there any worm in it. Now during the rest of the week, if they kept it overnight, it was spoiled in the morning. They couldn't eat it. It was spoiled and full of worms. In this case, on the sixth day, they gathered twice as much and kept it so they had food for the seventh day. Bill?
You mentioned they had to eat this for 40 years, which would be a long time on one particular diet. But I'm thinking also in the next few chapters that are, may not have been for 40 years if something had gone differently in a few chapters from now. And I'm talking about, the sin of the foot of Mount Sinai that actually made God make the decision where I'm going to kill you all off except for the children. They may have only had to be out there for a year eating this stuff.
Well, yeah.
It's possible. So in other words, you mentioned 40 years. And I think, again, and I know I'm assuming something there, but it's very possible that if they would have behaved themselves when they received the Ten Commandments, Moses went up into the Mount Sinai, that they may not have been out there.
Yeah, if they had gone on into the land of Canaan, that as from straight from Sinai as God had planned, then yes, they wouldn't have been eating this manna for 40 years.
You might look back and say, hey, remember that quail? We love that stuff.
Yeah. How many?
Different story.
How many of us like to eat the same food 7 days a week?
Nope.
Most of us want some variety in our lives, although there are places when variety is not really possible. Don, and then Dan. Apparently not. And that's assumption on my part that this is the first Sabbath. Now God is going to give them the Ten Commandments and reinforce the Sabbath law at Sinai, which is, we're not there yet.
So there was no 7-day cycle before this?
Probably not, and certainly not in Egypt, where the slave masters would not have allowed for that. Okay, Dan? Yes.
I believe there's a passage of scripture that God is saying he taken them in a different direction because they would not be ready to fight.
Right.
Going against the Philistines. So what's so loving and merciful about our God is that he knows our weaknesses and how dull of wit we are, that even when miracles are given to us to protect us and to sustain us, we complain. We complain about, Moses, because he's the nearest.
He's the target.
Nearest target. I think, it's all about us for looking at this. So, they didn't learn the lesson very well. They were taken care of. We cared for. They're out in the middle of the desert, and quail are coming to feed 3 million people. I mean, that's a lot of quail. And you're finding water, enough to water that many people in that kind of lifestyle. And today, sometimes I think we're the same way. God providentially cares for us and takes care of us. And it's almost the attitude of, yeah, that was yesterday, but what have you done for me lately?
Yeah. Yeah, we all tend to have that tendency. When things go wrong, our faith seems to weaken. Mike, you had a hand up a moment ago. I'll get you two guys later.
Yeah. The thing that impresses me is that this manna, although it was not something they came to enjoy, it must have been perfectly nutritious for them because they had a rather arduous journey to undertake, to cross the desert there. And, I find it hard to believe that during that entire time they didn't eat any of the herds or the flocks.
I certainly did some.
Yeah. And so the manna was a substantial portion, but it wasn't everything.
They didn't dare, though, eat all of their flocks up because that would be their sustenance when they got into Canaan. Andrew and Bill? Yeah.
And yet, they ended up not observing the Sabbath years at all.
Right.
Because God said that's one of the reasons why he took them into captivity for 7 years, so that the land could enjoy a Sabbath.
Yep.
So here's an example. Just an everyday, every week example, and they seem to miss the whole idea that God will provide.
Yeah, and we're likely to do the same thing. Bill?
Crossword was only 200 feet deep. Imagine walking through that and seeing that.
Yeah, we need to put our faith in God and trust in Him and recognize that complaining isn't going to do us a bit of good. It's probably going to do us more harm than good psychologically. So that, yeah, the complaining that they were doing did them no good. They had every reason not to, they should put their trust in God, but they did not. They complained about things. Don? Yeah.
Now, when the Pharaoh had let the people go, God did not lead them by the way of the land of the Philistines, even though it was near, for God said the people might change their minds when they see war and return to Egypt.
Yeah. Yeah. I was going to mention that too, but I didn't. The fact that I knew it was here in the book of Exodus, I hadn't got that far. Mike?
The thing I always got out of this was we have a tendency to look backwards and think things were perfect back when. Mm-hmm. And they did the same thing. We look around and think, well, I wish things were like it was 20 years ago in the church. We have problems 20 years ago too.
Amen. Yeah, that's right.
We have a tendency to look backwards at most of the classes.
Yeah.
Yep. Our memories are such that we remember the good and forget the bad. And they were certainly forgetting the bad that was going on in Egypt, but they were remembering that they had lots of meat to eat and stuff. You know, the thought of them having the same diet always reminded me of a story that I heard when I was in high school. So some speaker came through in an assembly. He was talking about the Chinese, and he said the Chinese people live on a diet of rice and greens. And for variety, they have greens and rice. And that was their entire lives, and had been for years, was that they were living on the same diet day after day after day after day. We look at that and say, if I've got to eat the same thing today that I had yesterday, I'm going to be upset about it. But you can do this. People do it even today, or did 50 years ago when I was in high school.
There's a joke that goes that a fellow was complaining about what his wife was serving. She was serving Chinese for the second day, and he says, who in the world eats Chinese food 2 days in a row?
Chinese do. Okay. So the house of Israel named it manna. It was like coriander seed, white, and its taste was like wafers with honey. So Moses said, this is what the Lord has commanded, that an omer full of it be gathered, be kept throughout your generations, that they may see the bread that I fed you in the wilderness when I brought you out of the land of Egypt. Moses said to Aaron, take a jar and put an omer full of manna in it and place it before the Lord to be kept throughout your generations. And this was later placed in the Ark of the Covenant. As the Lord commanded Moses, so Aaron placed it before the testimony to be kept. And the sons of Israel ate manna 40 years until they came to an inhabited land. They ate the manna until they came to the border of the land of Canaan. And I've got a note here that scholars are uncertain about the size of the omer, but it seems to be somewhere between a half a gallon and a gallon, somewhere in that range. Coriander it mentioned here, I didn't know what that was. It's also known as cilantro, which we can buy in the grocery store. We're buying the leaves, we're not buying the seeds. It says all parts of the plant are edible, but the fresh leaves and the dried seeds are the parts most traditionally used in cooking. So this is a picture of the coriander seeds. So it was something like this, in appearance at least, that they gathered. It was white. Its taste was very tasty, apparently, like wafers with honey, which would have been something of a treat. But that's just, again, interest is not of any real value to us as far as our salvation is concerned. Okay. So they've now crossed the Red Sea. They are now 3 or 4 days into the wilderness. It says that all the congregation of the sons of Israel journeyed by stages to the wilderness of Sin, according to the command of the Lord, encamped at Rephidim. and there was no water for the people to drink. Therefore the people quarreled with Moses and said, give us water that we may drink. So a week before, they were complaining about they were hungry. Now they're complaining that they're thirsty. So we see that they're not going to be satisfied no matter what. And if we expect people around us to be satisfied with the way things are going, don't. These people today aren't any different than people then in terms of how they behaved in that way. Moses said to them, why do you quarrel with me? Why do you test the Lord? But the people thirsted there for water, and they grumbled against Moses and said, why now have you brought us up from Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst? So, like I say, a week before, it was hunger. Now God is miraculously providing them food to eat, and they're thirsty. It's natural to be thirsty if you're out without something to drink. And I can remember growing up, the brothers and I'd go off someplace and be out somewhere all day long and not have taken enough water along with us, and we'd be thirsty, and it's certainly an unpleasant situation. I doubt that we were quite as thirsty as these people were. Bill?
Instead of complaining, complaining about it, what should we do?
Well, Moses did the right thing.
Nice answer. We should ask God, pray about it.
Okay.
And wait, right? Wait
yep.
for the answer. Not complain or doubt or anything else that might be us, you know, quite common human reaction, or get depressed or discouraged, or you can list a lot of things that happen that we go through when things don't happen the way we want them to.
Right. Okay, you know, I have always had the feeling that if you're dealing with a large body of people, the reaction you're going to get out of that large body of people is similar to the reaction a child would have. The bigger the large people, the younger the child. And if you think about how these people are behaving, think about how your small kids behaved when they didn't have what they wanted. And they tend to complain just a little bit. But we don't, we're supposedly all adults. And we should behave as adults, not as children. Verse 4, so.
It's much easier to discourage people than it is to encourage them.
Okay.
People like to, it's like they pick up on it so much faster. You are discouraging when it's like they feed on it somehow.
Yeah. Okay. So Moses cried out to the Lord, saying, what shall I do to this people? A little more and they will stone me. Then the Lord said to Moses, pass before the people and take with you some of the elders of Israel, and take in your hand the staff with which you struck the Nile, and go. Behold, I will stand before you there on the rock at Horeb, and you shall strike the rock, and water will come out of it, that the people may drink. And Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel. He named the place Massah and Meribah because of the quarrel of the sons of Israel, because they tested the Lord there, saying, is the Lord among us or not? So they're now not only questioning Moses, they're questioning, they're grumbling to Moses, but they're questioning God. Moses does seem to be getting frustrated here. They're going to stone me if they didn't get up. So he's a little concerned about what's going on, and that's a fairly normal human reaction. Anybody in a leadership position, those people aren't doing what I tell them to do, and then they complain because the results they get aren't what they expected and what I told them to do would have gotten for them. However, Moses does what he always does, and he turns to God for an answer. And again, we could hear an awfully good example of what we should do when things go wrong. Yeah, we're not going to be able to necessarily solve them ourselves. but turn to God, he will provide the answer. We may have to wait for it. These people did not have to wait for it, but they did what God had told them to do. Okay, and so Amalek came and fought against Israel at Rephidim. So they're in this middle of the second month now after they have left Egypt, and Amalek comes to attack them at Rephidim. Now, the Amalekites we typically would find over on the Sinai Peninsula, at least by the time of David and Saul, that's where they seemed to be living, was on the Sinai Peninsula. So this would put them, the Amalekites, over across the other side of the Gulf of Aqaba, which, I don't know, maybe goes a little bit against what we were talking about earlier, where the crossing took place. But the Amalekites could have gone anywhere in that particular region. So Moses said to Joshua, "Choose men for us and go out, fight against Amalek. Tomorrow I will station myself on the top of the hill with the staff of God in my hand." Joshua did as Moses told him and fought against Amalek. And Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up to the top of the hill. So it came about when Moses held his hand up that Israel prevailed. And when he let his hand down, Amalek prevailed. But Moses' hands were heavy, and they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat on it. And Aaron and Hur supported his hands, one on one side and one on the other. Thus his hands were steady until the sun set. So Joshua overwhelmed Amalek and his people with the edge of the sword. So Moses got this staff, and he's holding it up. How many hours can you hold your arm straight up like that? Not too many. And so they set Moses on a rock, and they hold his hands up for him so that it's not his strength that they are depending upon, but the strength of his two companions. Andrew?
It seems to me that Moses should have stopped after he told Joshua to choose men and go. This whole thing is just odd to me, that Moses would take it upon himself to go and stand and hold his hand up and all that. First of all, you're right, lacks foresight. But God doesn't need Moses there to win a battle.
I think the point here that we should get out of this, and probably the children of Israel should have gotten out of this, was that God was intervening in the battle, and as long as Moses was doing what he said he was going to do or what God told him to do, we're not given any indication of which, the battle went their way. If he failed to do what God had told him to do, or what he had told God he would do, then the battle went the other way. So we need to look at that in our lives to some degree too. As long as we're doing what God has told us to do, he's going to be there and to support us. If we turn our back on him and go the other way, then it's going to go against us. Andrew?
And it's always good to have friends by your side when you get tired.
Oh, yes. And so when we've got problems and we need somebody to hold our hand up, we look around. There's plenty of people around that are perfectly willing to do so. The support is there, and God is obviously influencing this battle as to how it is going. It is not purely military strategy that is carrying on and leading the children of Israel to victory in this battle. It's an army that has never fought a battle before. And God says they're so unprepared to fight a war that I'm not going to lead them through the land of the Philistines. And so there is some miraculous aspects to this battle as well, besides just the Moses holding up his arms.
We know that the Egyptians certainly didn't encourage the Israelites to attain any military skill.
No.
They were kept as herdsmen and farmers and such. So, for them to be able to withstand the attack of this aggressor nation that, you know, just takes it upon themselves out of nowhere to come and jump on their backs and try to eradicate them, you know, to me that, if not a miracle, it's certainly a wonder and a cause for amazement, and as you said, certainly an indication that God is with them.
Yeah, there's things that we're going to face in life which we can't stand up to and can't handle alone. We have to turn and depend upon God, and we have to depend upon our companions that are with us along that road, which Moses did at this point. And Moses didn't seem to object to having Aaron and Hur holding his arms up. He was perfectly willing to accept that kind of support. He did not feel that he had to stand there with the staff in his hand and hold it up here all day long. Or maybe he had it like this, but either way, it's difficult to hold your hands up there for hours and hours at a time, which is what we needed at this particular time. We're talking about the spring of time of the year, so days are about roughly 12 hours long. And so he stood up there until the sun went down. And so it was a long day. Then the Lord said to Moses, write this in a book as a memorial and recite it to Joshua, that I will utterly blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. Moses built an altar and named it, the Lord is my banner. And he said, the Lord has sworn, the Lord will have war against Amalek from generation to generation. And we know that Saul, the great sin that Saul created was when God told him to go down and utterly destroy the Amalekites. He went down and did most of what God had told him to do. He kept some of the livestock, which God had told them not to do, and he kept the king alive until Samuel slew him. So that destroyed most of Amalek's power, although now we see David, when he was living with the Philistines, and the Philistines went up to war against Saul, with the battle where Saul was killed, and David was sent back because they didn't want a bunch of Hebrews along with the Philistine army. Some strange thinking on their part somehow. But the Amalekites had raided the city where David's families were and had taken off all their families and all of their possessions from there. And so Saul had not utterly destroyed the Amalekites, but that's the last mention of them, I believe, in the Bible, at least that I can think of anyway. The Amalekites disappeared pretty much from that point on. The only other place where you might have an indication of Amalek was some people believe that Haman, the man who wanted to destroy the children of Israel in the book of Esther, was an Amalekite. But basically that nation disappeared, and most of history doesn't record anything about them. And well, we didn't get very far today. We haven't got to Mount Sinai yet. I think it's time for us to break, and we'll get back to it here next week. Okay? Thank you.